It's fall, and things are definitely falling. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
As always, good to be with you in the studio. In my studio, with you in your studio, we're, what, 130 miles apart?
Yes, it's the magic of technology, and we're being broadcast from a studio that is probably at least 30 or 40 miles away from you.
That's right.
So it's all good, ladies and gentlemen. Yesterday is officially the first day of fall season, and you know, with fall, we expect certain things in the fall. The leaves change, the air gets a little crisper, a little brisk. You have the deer moving in the woods more, and you see them more near the highways or what's left of them on the highways. And football and fall sports, and one of the biggest fall sports we have, Chuck, happens at once every 4 years, and that's a presidential election season. And usually fall is when things really start going a little crazy in election time, in a presidential race, and with some of the down ticket races as well. And I believe that this year, this fall, is no exception whatsoever. Boy, we've got so much to talk about some of the issues around the fall race. I'm not sure, Chuck, which one should take priority, but, you know, we talked about this ahead of time, so we're going to open up with people taking the fall. Because that's kind of what's happening right now. Ladies and gentlemen, around the issue of a initiative called Fast and Furious. Many of you may be aware of this. This was an operation that was run by Justice Department. It supposedly started back in 2006 under the George Bush Justice Department and was continued on, or at least that's what current Attorney General Eric Holder wants everybody to believe, that this all happened in the Bush administration. So in other words, it's George Bush's fault that guns, many, many hundreds, if not thousands of guns, semi-automatics and automatics, found their way into the hands of Mexican drug cartel leaders and their field troopers, and were used against U.S. border agents and other personnel. But the guns were supplied by the Justice Department. Imagine that, our Justice Department arming an illegal drug cartel in another country.
Well, let's actually talk about how it was done, because they weren't supplied directly.
Oh, no, not directly. That would have been too simple.
They were supplied by order of the Justice Department. Now, what do we mean by that? What was happening was that borderland U.S. side gun dealers were noticing that there were an inordinate amount of gun purchases, semi-automatics, and that kind of thing, and ammunition from people who had, shall we say, suspect records, suspect identifications, suspect reasoning for buying guns.
Are these the kind of type of purchases that are known as straw purchases, Chuck?
They are known very much so as straw purchases, and we better explain that. What it means is someone with an upstanding legal record goes in and buys a gun in order to be able to do a private transaction and sell that gun to someone who has a less than sterling record, who might not be able to buy a gun. That's known as a straw man purchase. It's essentially a third party purchase. And what was happening was that there are rules against that. There are very potent federal rules against that. And we can argue that the Second Amendment doesn't allow the federal government to ban straw man purchases. That's an argument for another show. The fact is, the law that is currently there and is being enforced says there are no straw man purchases. All right. So these dealers were essentially doing what they're supposed to do. They were calling the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and saying, this can't be right. You know, I've got to call it in because I've got the yellow sheet, but there's something wrong with this attempt at a purchase. And the local offices of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms were looking at them, realizing who the people were who were buying the guns, and say, nope, sell them to them. Sell them whatever they want. And even beyond protests from the dealers themselves, this is illegal. I do not want you in my office hauling me off and closing my business down, scapegoating me for selling these things. And they're like, don't worry about it. This is part of an operation. Sell them. Well, there were two attempts at this thing. There was the George Bush attempt. And the way that one worked was a little different than the way the Holder, the gun walking, worked.
Right, exactly. And this, it gets confusing, ladies and gentlemen, but we're hopefully here to clarify it a little bit so you can separate fact from, well, fantasy.
Yeah, the way it worked in the Bush administration is that they actually implanted RFID chips on the guns so they could be traced. So it was done as a BATF operation, a direct BATF operation, basically.
And the BATF, for our listeners' edification, is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and now Explosives. So BATFE, actually. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, which is overseen by the U.S. Justice Department.
Right. Yeah. Eric Holder being the boss there. Okay. Under the Bush administration, those things were tracked, and the actual people buying the guns were tracked, and they were tracked to the places where they were going, the criminals they were going to, and then that information was used to arrest and prosecute those criminals. Now, Mexico has a very stringent gun policy there. They don't want any revolution, and therefore you're not allowed to own a gun. You have not been allowed to own a gun in Mexico since very early in the 20th century. And it's that way so that basically the party that's in power can maintain power. But that being said, they have a very stringent policy. So they don't like the fact that sometimes people come over here and buy guns and go back across. Well, that's actually forbidden. And if you know someone's a citizen of Mexico, it's illegal to sell them a gun. You're only supposed to sell guns to citizens of the United States. Well, Barry, you know, with our current immigration policy, it's very difficult to tell the players without a scorecard.
Well, and the question is the scorecard counterfeit or not?
Well, exactly. Who knows if somebody's a citizen of the United States or not? And the answer is the federal government pretends like it doesn't know. Now, clearly it does in the case of gun ownership. It doesn't only in the case of voter registration, to show you the rather odd dichotomy that has gone on in this country. And also it goes into date myself. There used to be a politician named Bill Dana, and he used to do a Cuban named Jose Jimenez. I don't know if you remember this or not.
I do remember this, yes.
My name, Jose Jimenez. Nobody knew where Jose Jimenez was from, and that was kind of the whole joke. And what's going on here is we've got a bunch of people who show up, they might speak with a heavy Mexican accent when they ask for the late Bill Smith's ballot. They're handed to him, and they also may have his Social Security card. Meanwhile, Mr. Smith might have been dead for 10 or 15 years.
Indeed.
And everybody looks the other way. After all, we can't stop people from voting. It's a very strange operation. In the meantime, people are going over to taking these guns over to Mexico and committing crimes, including shooting and immigration officers.
Let's walk that back just a little bit. What happened, folks, is that under the Obama administration, during this time period from about 3 years ago, fall of 2009, through about the end of 2010, the Obama Justice Department under Eric Holder continued this program, except as far as I can tell, Chuck, they didn't do the RFID chip emplacement into the guns. They just allowed straw buyers to buy numerous firearms, including over 2,000 firearms in that time period. Mainly AK-47s were sold and allowed to walk. That means that they were allowed to take them across the border and get out of their jurisdiction. Well, over that time period, only 100 of those 2,000 guns, because they weren't being tracked with an RFID chip, were recovered. Now, the big problem is, in January of 10, a gentleman by the name of Jaime Avila, was a, and somebody that the ATF office in Phoenix, Arizona, or was it Tucson? I think it was either Phoenix, yeah, Phoenix, Arizona. The special agent in charge was a guy by the name of Bill Newell. Now, Newell knew Jaime Avila. And basically, this guy walks into a gun store in Phoenix and buys three AK-47s. And on December 14th of 2010, two of those three AK-47s finally turned up again. They were left at the murder scene of U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. So, the Holder Justice Department, who looked the other way while someone purchased guns that they knew were going to go into the hands of, well, criminals, ended up causing the death of a Border Patrol agent, an American citizen. Well, that was at the time that they shut the program down, supposedly. Operation Fast and Furious was shut down, and they actually arrested the buyer. Jaime Avila was arrested. However, this has led to Congress, especially Daryl Issa, who is the chairman of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, basically coming down and extremely furious, coming down fast and extremely furious at the Holder Justice Department and wanting answers. Well, Chuck, what do you think? Do you think that Daryl Issa is going to get answers?
No, of course not. And in fact, this report that was just issued by the, basically, this is what amounts to an internal Justice Department probe, wherein the Attorney General was given a clean bill of health by their internal investigator. Now, Barry, does that shock anybody? Seriously. Is anybody shocked that Eric Holder was given a clean bill of health by an internal investigation?
Well, there's a little bit more to that story than meets the eye, Chuck, because I was looking at an article on CNSnews.com. That's one of our favorite spots to go, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, you can always go there and take a look at what we're looking at. There's an article by Fred Lucas a couple days ago that was headlined, "Inspector General, White House Made It Impossible to Pursue Lead in Fast and Furious Probe."
Exactly.
Well, the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, who is the Inspector General for the Justice Department, basically has come before Daryl Issa's committee, the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, and basically after releasing the report called A Review of ATF's Operation Fast and Furious and Related Matters, they came before this congressional oversight panel to answer questions. Well, the big revelation, according to Inspector General Michael Horowitz, is that the White House stonewalled. They would not release information. They made it, as the Inspector General says, that they made it impossible for them to pursue that aspect of the case. In other words, what did the White House know? How involved were they in it? And were there directives given from the administration through the Attorney General that continued this program and ultimately caused the death of Border Patrol Agent Terry?
Well, there's other issues involved here. They're actually, the IG, the Inspector General, wanted to have a conversation with someone on the national security team, and they were stopped from doing so by the president. Now, here's the problem, Barry. If the president of the United States really wanted to get at the bottom of this, why did he declare executive privilege on all documents having to do with Fast and Furious, all communications, all emails, all memos,
And as you see, ladies and gentlemen, there's the rub. As this investigation was unwinding and the Inspector General was starting to dig into it at the behest of Chairman Issa of the House Government Oversight and Reform, the White House went radio silent. The president issued an executive order claiming executive privilege over all the communications surrounding this particular issue. Makes you wonder why. And as a matter of fact, Chuck, that person you're talking about that they were trying to get an interview with was Kevin O'Reilly, who was on the Obama's national security staff. And they tried to do that, but O'Reilly lawyered up and wouldn't allow the Inspector General to interview him. So that in itself is honestly not surprising, because if you've got something to hide, you usually lawyer up and try not to say anything.
Well, the fact is, and Barry, I still have a question that no one has yet to answer. Why, oh, why, oh, why would you buy an AK-47 on the U.S. side of the border where it's going to cost you about $500 or $600? A bottom-of-the-line one, standard old AK-47 out of a Chinese box or out of one of the...
Or a Czech model.
Czech box or one of the other, or possibly even the old Yugoslavia, some of the old places you could buy them out of the box there. It's going to cost you $500 or $600. You can buy those black market, fully auto.
Not that we know anything about this, though.
No, I mean, that's the word. You can buy them black market, fully auto, for under $200.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, maybe those. Maybe that's part of those 1,900 missing guns that the Justice Department can't seem to track of the 2,000 that they let walk across the border.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows, Barry? You know, the black marketeers are the guys who deal internationally. Usually they're probably Russian mafia, that kind of thing. And they may be stolen, they may be bought black market on the other end and sold black market on this end. But those are the guys who supply revolutionary movement and that kind of thing. That's why the guns are cheap. Well, an AK-47 is an extremely simple weapon. It's also very fun to fire, if you've ever fired one.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have. And listeners might remember that Rick Finke, who was formerly with WLRY, used to have machine gun shoots out at the farm. And Chuck and I were both recipients of his hospitality and got a chance to put our hands on a number of different fun and exciting things, including an AK-47.
Well, yeah, and I'll be quite honest, those AK-47s were completely street legal, and by that I mean they were federal stamped,
yep.
And the taxes were paid, and when you do that, you can own an automatic firearm. There are all kinds of them out there. You can own 50 calibers, you can own belt feds, you can own M60s, you can own all kinds of stuff as long as you have the federal stamp, and you have the money to pay for the federal stamp, which, by the way, is not cheap, and you have to be able to pass the ATF. There is a requirement. You have to apply for the stamp and be able to pass the security examination for that. For under the current way the government thinks, it's understandable. But that being said, again, I still don't understand why people were buying, except that possibly AK-47s on this side of the border at a premium are available now. And on the black market, they're available whenever they can smuggle them in. That would be the only reason why you would buy a semi-automatic only $600 AK-47. You want it now.
Yeah, exactly.
So about 2,000 of them. Now, what does that tell you about how many of the under $200 black market ones are floating around in Mexico? There's lots of them.
Wouldn't doubt that a bit.
Yeah, and not just Mexico, but all of Central America, anywhere where there's a revolutionary movement. That's why you'll always see AK-47s as the weapon of choice and not the American equivalent, the M16, or the sport model, which I have one of, an AR-15, which is a semi-automatic only. You will not see those used because the AK is cheap, it's simple, it's easy to keep firing. The AR-15 is much harder to get parts and ammo and all that other stuff for. NATO keeps a little heavier lock on it. So that being said, what's going on here, Barry, is that there is clearly something going on. And I'll be quite honest. You and I raised this question, and we still need to interview Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America about this. And I'm going to look into that for next week if I can. I want to ask, was this part of a wider plan to have a hue and cry from our Mexican neighbor for us to do something about controlling the flow of weapons and therefore getting involved in the UN Small Arms Treaty? For us to ratify the UN Small Arms Treaty on the basis of what was going on with Fast and Furious. And the more I learn and the more lawyered up everybody gets and the more Eric Holder hides behind really obviously ginned up reports, the more obvious it becomes to me that that's exactly what the plan was. Pardon me for being paranoid.
Well,
but this,
I don't believe it's paranoid, Chuck, because I find this interesting because the one person that the Inspector General really wants to talk to, this Kevin O'Reilly, he was, well, shall we say, shifted in his responsibilities. He was in the fall of 2011, so last year when this investigation was first getting going, the White House sent O'Reilly from the National Security Staff to the State Department. But his duty station is Iraq. So in other words, they shipped him off to Iraq, and basically his attorney, it's reported in this article on CNS News, that O'Reilly's attorney said that his client would agree to a telephone interview with the committee, but only if the White House said okay. Well, what did the White House say? Well, White House counsel Catherine Rumler said this: there is an insufficient basis to support the request to interview Mr. O'Reilly, and cited executive branch confidentiality interests. In other words, it's going right back to Obama's order of executive privilege.
And the only way the president can legally declare executive privilege is if it is it's an operation that the president has firsthand knowledge of,
right?
And it has to do with generally with national security.
No, wait a minute, Chuck. An operation that the president has firsthand knowledge of? Hasn't Barack Obama, ever since this investigation started, flat out denied that the White House had any knowledge that this was going on whatsoever?
Oh, of course they have, and that really calls that into question now, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It calls it into deep question, and it's a question that I'm sure the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee Chairman Daryl Issa wants answered.
Well, listen, Barry, this is also very interesting. O'Reilly being moved to Iraq is a little like being in the shower when somebody wants to get you on the phone. We're sorry, he's in the shower.
Exactly.
That's an old Jerry Seinfeld bit, too, you know. He says, yeah, it's the only place you can go and get away from the phone. We're sorry, he won't come out, and he's in the shower, and we just can't do anything about it. You know, he can't come to the phone, he's in the shower.
Now, Chuck, I've seen something. I was at the phone store the other day trying to get a replacement charger cord, and they now have a thing you can put over your portable, your iPhone, whatever, your smartphone, that you can drop it in 6 feet of water, and it won't harm the phone.
The Otter.
Yeah, it's a different style than the Otter. This one was like about $80 or $90 to get this thing. So I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to go to that last frontier and make Jerry Seinfeld answer his phone.
That's right. They've already got him in the car. Between the time that little bit came out, which was like in about 1985 or so, and now, of course, the car phones are common because everybody's got their cell in their car. In fact, when I was in California, I got yelled at by the police over a loudspeaker to hang up the phone and drive, which was a real treat, let me tell you, as a visitor in California. But that being the case, O'Reilly basically doesn't have a car phone or a shower phone. He's in Iraq, and he's got executive privilege, and he's not talking.
Exactly. They sequestered him away in a safe house, and he will not be giving an interview. It's interesting because Attorney General Holder is out basically saying now that he's totally exonerated on this issue. Because if you remember, there were some calls for impeachment of the Attorney General over the stonewalling on this particular case.
Well, Holder, to show his unbridled arrogance, has basically come out and now chided the House Government Oversight Committee for leaping to conclusions, which have now been dealt with by this internal report. Meanwhile, the Inspector General is saying, why not so fast? Not so fast. So the fact is that the shoe has not finished dropping on this yet, Barry. But let me just say this, anybody really believes there's no bias in the mainstream media, put George W. Bush in office having done it this way and see what the American press would have done with this. George W. Bush would probably, they would probably be seriously talking about impeachment for the president at this point. And bandying about every night. In the meantime, the mainstream media is basically doing their best to cover this up and say that what a horrible mistake, what a gaffe the Republicans have made by, you know, not doing their homework and messing this up in Congress and blah, 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 as if they're, that Holder is really exonerated by this report, which he's not.
Well, according to Holder, he is, because, now again, remember, this was an internal investigation in the Justice Department's Office of Inspector General. So, in other words, we are reviewing our boss. Oh, gee, let's see. Well, he didn't have any role or knowledge of this operation. Now, this is, Chuck, this is a major operation that was taking place at the time that Eric Holder was sitting as Attorney General. It went on for more than a year and a half. 2,000 guns had flowed under the noses of the special agent in charge, Bill Newell, in the Phoenix office of the FBI. And he's saying that he'd had no knowledge, that the top boss in the Justice Department didn't know about an operation that his department had been running for a year and a half until after it was all over with. Now, well, that tells me, that says one of two things. Either they're lying through their teeth, or Eric Holder is the most out-of-touch attorney general that has ever been in the office, to the point where he either refuses to be briefed, doesn't want to be briefed, doesn't understand his briefings, or avoids being briefed on certain operations that he thinks that might be politically sensitive.
Well, the game here is plausible deniability.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Rogers, you know, can you say that? Plausible deniability?
Plausible deniability. I thought
sure,
you could.
Sure. I knew you could.
I knew you could.
That's what's going on here. Eric Holder's playing plausible deniability. Every time somebody wanted to talk about this thing, he just stuck his finger in his ears and went, la, 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 la. Didn't hear it. Nope. Didn't see the memo. Shred it. So, essentially, this, we're not going to get to the bottom of this till after the election, and if the Republicans prevail, it's going to go away. That's the bottom line. There will be no point anymore.
Absolutely.
And that's a sad thing, because the prosecution should take place. An American border agent was killed, and Eric Holder is ultimately responsible for that death, and he should be tried for it. Now,
like I said, though, Chucky, it's fall, and so things are falling. And what's going to fall is the blow falls below Eric Holder, and some people under him in the leadership of their criminal division, or the field agent in charge in Phoenix, Arizona, is probably going to be the ones losing their jobs.
Well, 14 people have already lost their jobs, Barry. In fact, there were 5 top ATF agents have already resigned over this, because the report basically pointed them out, and Holder's going to cut their heads off and put them on his office wall and say, see what we did? We got rid of these bad players. Meanwhile, his own head should be on that office wall. But that's the way the game is played, and I hate to say this, but especially on the Democratic side of the aisle, the rank and file are expected to sacrifice themselves for the dear leader, and that looks like what has happened in this case.
Well, and again, and you keep looking into this, according to the report, the Inspector General basically said that although the Office of the Attorney General received various weekly reports from components in the department that mentioned Operation Fast and Furious, the Inspector General's investigation, found that Attorney General Holder did not personally review these reports at the time that his office received them, and that his staff did not highlight them for his review. In other words, they're giving him updates, and he's just not reading them.
Well,
so that's interesting. That here's the man who's supposed to be at the top, calling the shots, the quarterback for the Justice Department, and he's not even bothering to read the update memos that are being sent to him by his field staff, giving him information on all the various things that the Justice Department is involved in. Chuck, that's almost criminal negligence.
And it is that plausible deniability that we just talked about. He can say that he truly knows nothing of it.
Well, I'm sure that someday the truth is going to be made known, and we're going to find out that he probably knew a lot more about this operation than he's letting on. And so did his boss.
Well, oh, absolutely. You know, Barry, this is a good breaking spot. Let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll discuss a few more issues.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half of today's edition of Principles and Policies. Chuck and I have been talking about this whole Operation Fast and Furious mess where basically the Obama Justice Department distributed weapons to Mexican drug cartel members, and they turned around and used them on American Border Patrol agents like Brian Terry, who was murdered by those same weapons. Well, Chuck, I honestly see a theme with the Obama administration, and it's a theme that I think falls into this fall election cycle, and that's one of distribution, or I guess it would be more accurate to say redistribution. And I think it would be extremely accurate to say redistribution, since the president himself, the Mitt Romney campaign, is now out there getting a lot of headway with a comment from a video that was taken of Barack Obama early on in his political career, where he, well, shall we say, showed that he was a little warm to the idea of redistribution by government.
A little warm? Yeah, actually, we have a copy, as everybody in the United States can get it. It's right on YouTube of Barack Obama talking about how he is in favor of redistribution in order to give, quote, everybody a shot. Well, redistribution of income and wealth does not give everybody a shot. What it does is it shoots everybody out of the sky, because what it does, of course, is it requires onerous taxation in order to make it work.
No, but it does give everybody a shot. It gives everybody a shot of government intervention.
Well, bingo. How well is that working out for GM? You know, GM is begging the federal government to sell their shares. I forget what percentage of GM they own, like 28% or something. They're begging the federal government to sell off their shares because they're contacting old customers about coming in and getting a new car. And they said, I'm not buying a car from Government Motors.
Exactly. And that's how the free market system is supposed to work. People vote with their pocketbooks.
Exactly. But, of course, this administration does not believe in that. You actually have to hear this speech and in fact, I think, gosh, what are we going to do? We were planning on playing this for our listeners, weren't we?
I think so.
We're going to be one of the few places you can hear it, because unless you're listening, the mainstream media certainly isn't playing it. In fact, they're coming out and saying, well, we haven't really vetted the tape, so we can't play it.
Well, it's interesting, Chuck, because they've not vetted the tape much, that they are now out there, MSNBC and others, spinning it that, well, the Romney campaign truncated the tape, because it actually said more than that. So I guess if they think they can spin the meme in order to make their guy look good, then the tape's vetted well enough.
Well, they've had to listen to it at least once, and they've had to listen to a larger section of it. It's very difficult. In fact, we're going to play this. We're going to let you judge for yourself, but it's very difficult that anybody could take this, could claim that this particular piece, which is a minute and 36 seconds long, is really ripped out of its context. The entire recording gives all the context that's necessary to understand this piece.
Let me just close by saying, as we think about the policy research surrounding the issues that I just named, policy research for the working poor, broadly defined, I think that what we're going to have to do is somehow resuscitate the notion that government action can be effective at all. There has been a systematic, I don't think it's too strong to call it a propaganda campaign, against the possibility of government action and its efficacy. And I think some of it has been deserved. You know, Chicago Housing Authority has not been a model of good policy making, and neither necessarily have been the Chicago Public Schools. What that means then is that as we try to resuscitate this notion that we're all in this thing together, leave nobody behind, We do have to be innovative in thinking what are the delivery systems that are actually effective and meet people where they live. And my suggestion, I guess, would be that the trick, this is one of the few areas where I think there are technical issues that have to be dealt with as opposed to just political issues. I think the trick is figuring out how do we structure government systems that pool resources and hence facilitate some redistribution, because I actually believe in redistribution, at least at a certain level, to make sure that everybody's got a shot.
And there it is, Barry.
That's fine, and I don't think we need to hear it again. But, you know, and I'm going to go ahead, and for the purpose of our listeners, so that we can say that we're being fair and balanced, I'm going to read the rest of the clip, because I found the text of it. And after he says that, he says, how do we pool resources at the same time as we decentralize delivery systems in ways that both foster competition, can work in the marketplace, and can foster innovation at the local level, and can be tailored to particular communities? Well, Chuck, that all sounds good, and the mainstream media is trying to say, oh, he was talking, praising competition in the marketplace. And again, it's just like anything else. You have to parse it carefully.
Yes.
He's saying, first of all, we have to structure government systems to pool resources. That's redistribution, Chuck. How do we pool resources at the same time? So in other words, honestly, he makes it sound like he's looking at this broad-based solution when he's saying, how do we pool resources? In other words, that is my preferred method right there. At the same time as we decentralize delivery systems that foster competition, work in the marketplace, and foster innovation. In other words, he's setting up an either or.
Yeah, it's a false dichotomy.
It's a false dichotomy. He's not embracing the free market. He's in favor of redistribution. He said it. That's his preferred method. You know, we are going to pull resources. And how do we do that at the same time as everybody else is saying, decentralized delivery, blah, 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 blah. So in other words, he's saying pooling resources is the primary reason for government. And we have to, and I'm not sure how we can do both. So, yeah, I think it's interesting, Chuck, because he also, I think, and I don't see the mainstream or the conservative media picking up on this part of it, because they all focused in on this whole thing about redistribution.
Yes.
He hit on, and this was an audio from a interview or a meeting in 1998 at a conference in Chicago, okay, when he was an Illinois state senator. He says something in that at the opening, and maybe we will play this little part again for people, where he says it's something we're all a part of. Chuck, that was the theme of the DNC at their convention two and a half weeks ago, was that government is the only thing that we are all part of. Obama's been carrying this theme now for 14 years, that government is the be-all and end-all. And as many of our listeners have probably been aware, if you've been out on the blogs or Facebook or other places, even to the point of the Obama campaign has put out a new graphic changing the American flag to have the Obama O logo up in the field of blue and saying that that is their flag now, and having a program where they're getting people, big-name people, people like Natalie Portman and other movie actors, to basically, they're pledging allegiance to Obama. Now, Chuck, that has all kinds of shadowing of things we've seen in the past. And I'm not going to be the one to draw a direct analogy between what Obama's doing and certain other socialist leadership in our world's history, but you know where I'm going to.
Yes. Now, yeah, Barry, in fact, I have dug up those two recordings. So how about if we listen to those two things juxtaposed with one another, 14 years apart, and yet the meme is exactly the same.
The same, yeah. Let's listen to Obama's opening from that comment that the Romney campaign is using the wrong part of, I believe, Chuck.
Yes, I agree. Okay, here's Obama.
Let me just close by saying, as we think about the policy research surrounding the issues that I just named, policy research for the working poor, broadly defined, I think that what we're going to have to do is somehow resuscitate the notion that government action can be effective at all. There has been a systematic, I don't think it's too strong to call it a propaganda campaign, against the possibility of government action and its efficacy. And I think some of it has been deserved. Chicago Housing Authority has not been a model of good policy making, and neither necessarily have been the Chicago Public Schools. What that means then is that as we try to resuscitate this notion that we're all in this thing together, leave nobody behind, we do have to be innovative in thinking what are the delivery systems that are actually effective and meet people where they live. And my suggestion, I guess, would be that the trick, this is one of the few areas where I think there are technical issues that have to be dealt with as opposed to just political issues. I think the trick is figuring out how do we structure government systems that pool resources and hence facilitate some redistribution, because I actually believe in redistribution, at least at a certain level, to make sure that everybody's got a shot.
Okay. So here we had, we're leaving no one behind.
That's right. We're all in this together.
And we got to pool resources so that everybody can get a shot through our redistribution. All right. Here's the Democratic National Committee. Here's the one of the opening speeches.
The video. This is the video that they played at the opening of the convention to set the theme for the entire convention.
And I rather like one of the top comments here. It's someone commented in his only words are folksy fascism. And that pretty much covers it. Okay.
We are committed to all people. We do believe you can use government in a good way. Well, government's the only thing that we all belong to. We're in different churches, different clubs, but we're together as a part of our city or our county or our state and our nation.
There you go, Barry.
That's it.
We're all in it together.
And government's the only thing that we're all a part of, so therefore government needs to tell us how to live and will redistribute money for us.
And that last comment, folksy fascism, that's exactly what they're talking about. Because this is what, if you recall, back during the Bill Clinton days, Bill Clinton made it clear, and Hillary came up with this phrase. Hillary and Bill's economic advisors came up with something that Bill was trying to implement at the time. And they called it the third way.
Third way, right. And he was being helped by Tony Blair of Britain, who was also advocating this third way platform.
And the third way, this mysterious third way, was supposedly not capitalism and not communism, but some mysterious thing in between that was a mix of business and government. Well, Barry, what is the mixture of business and government?
Well, you have two ends of it. It's either socialism or fascism, depending on how much government you mix in your business.
Well, and of course, really, fascism fits under the socialist rubric.
Yes, it does.
Because under that scenario, private businesses are owned and maintained by their ownership, but the resources, including the labor, are provided by the state. And the markets are provided by the state. And therefore, you have a quote-unquote public-private partnership. So when you hear us railing against the idea of public-private partnerships, because what it is that mysterious third way that Bill Clinton was talking about. And what Bill Clinton was talking about was the fascism that essentially, we're going to give you a real quick history of, a real quick economic history of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, grew out of something called, it began as mercantilism, what was called British mercantilism. It went to what was called corporatism. Now, we had, if you recall, Barry, when we taught our Institute on the Constitution class, we had a student who was very interested in a couple of Catholic thinkers, Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton.
Yes.
And I personally, I enjoy both writers as well. But both writers were railing against what these people called capitalism. And what they were trying to bring about was something called distributism.
Yes, distributism.
Okay. Well, when you and I got into it and started reading, and we suddenly realized that distributism was nothing more or less than socialism administered by the church.
By the church, that's right. In other words, it was an ecclesiocracy of socialism.
Yeah, exactly. It was a socialism run by the church. The church would basically come into possession of all property and decide who needed what to do what. And they would decide what has value and what doesn't and how it would be redistributed. Well, we saw the problem in that immediately. Now, what these guys, Bloch and Chesterton, were railing against was what they called capitalism, but wasn't capitalism at all. It was corporatism.
Mm-hmm.
And what corporatism was really, and again, here's a big word, proto-fascism.
Proto-fascism, that's right.
In other words, there was a direct reliance of big business on government to create and protect its markets. And not only that, but provide its resources. And folks, if you think this is something new, this goes back to the British East India Tea Company.
Yes, it does. So any of you who've watched Pirates of the Caribbean, you know what we're talking about.
That's right. I mean, if you want to tie it all up, now we've got 10 minutes, so we're really not going to be able to do a history of the growth of fascism from the British East India Tea Company. But let's suffice it to say that the American Revolution is a direct outgrowth of the adoption of corporatism by the British government.
That's
because
correct.
What was happening there was the British government was attempting to protect tea and sugar markets from French and Spanish raiders and to expand those markets. And in order to do that, they had to tax American colonists. Since the American colonists were a little reluctant to pay a tax on goods that they thought should be marketed freely without government interference, then
yes,
something grew out of that. And it was called the Revolution.
It was called the American War for Independence. That's exactly what it was.
And we've just given you a snapshot of why what's happening is coming full circle around to what we were doing. You know, in, I believe, yesterday's show, it was either yesterday's or Thursday's show, we talked about some of the things, it was Thursday's show, we talked about some of the things happening in the government that are full circle on the 235th anniversary of the passage out of the convention of the Constitution, that's 17th of September, 1787, the exact same things going on in our government that those guys wrote the Constitution to prevent. And when you adopt these economic systems, the same kinds of things have to start happening.
Yes.
And we have slowly but surely adopting these practices and these marketing and these government-private partnerships since the Civil War. But let's take a look at it. Alexander Hamilton was a major proponent of British mercantilism.
Yeah, that was his preferred economic engine for the fledgling American colonies.
Now, to be fair to him, he believed it could be controlled.
Didn't learn from any of the history that had just recently come before him and was not a very deep thinker, I don't think, on these things.
Yeah, Hamilton gets a lot of credit for being a lot smarter than I think he was. But also, do you know what Alexander Hamilton's training was?
I believe he was brought up by Presbyterian ministers.
Well, he was a shipping...
He was a shipping clerk.
He was more beyond a clerk. He actually ran a shipping corporation for a man who had more or less adopted him because he was more or less an orphan. This man adopted him at the age of 14, and he was routing sugar, rum, sugar cane, and a number of other crops out of Nevis and St. Kitts to international markets at the age of 14. He was running the company. So he wasn't a dummy. And he took that training and decided that what would be the best thing for companies like that that he ran would be a government-private partnership. This is one thing that you get when you read bad books with your filters on. I got this Ron Chernow's book on Alexander Hamilton.
Right.
Ron Chernow wrote this what cannot only be described as a hagiography. And I will explain what that is to the audience if they don't know what a hagiography is. A hagiography is a book that is written to apply sainthood to a certain person, usually the subject of the book. And Ron Chernow did his best to make Alexander Hamilton, who was not a saint, into one.
Right. Basically, whitewashing history so that your subject of your investigation never does any wrong.
And once you learn how to read history with your filters on and to understand what certain phrases mean in history when liberal professors and historians use them, you'd be amazed with how many doors that opens up when you read histories. And when I read Chernow's book, I had my filters all on, and I suddenly understood Hamilton's character. He's not completely the villain that some want to make him in to be, but he's more villain than saint. Let's put it that way. Yeah. He was really a proto-fascist.
Yes.
Our problems in government right now stem from Hamilton's work to undermine what happened at the Constitutional Convention. And you have to remember that Alexander Hamilton quit the convention and went home because he did not get what he wanted, and that was what amounted to a monarchy.
Well, what we can hope now, Chuck, to bring this full circle in this conversation, is that our current smartest man in the room, Barack Obama, doesn't get what he wants either and goes home soon. Because
here's the problem.
His version of proto-fascism actually steps all the way into Marxist collectivism.
And here's the problem, Barry. You know, the only stopper that we have right now for Barack Obama is Mitt Romney. And the only question I have is, who's going to stop Mitt Romney in 4 years?
Yeah, well, and we can get into that in a later program, and we will, ladies and gentlemen, because we're gonna break down some of the differences and similarities between those two candidates as we go through and heading into the election. I'm Chuck, we may lose some listeners over that later, but you know what? We have a responsibility to lay it out as we see it. So on this particular topic, we have to understand that Barack Obama is carrying on a consistent theme that government is the primary engine for everything, that government and government redistribution is the solution for all of the ills and woes. We're talking, you know, that all your policies need to be centered around this redistribution idea. And government, because it's something that it's the only thing we're all a part of, Chuck. You know that.
Well, that's right. We just heard that.
We were just told that. And, you know, since you've been told that, then it was coming from experts, then it must be true.
Well, think about this. The third way of Bill Clinton goes back to 1993.
Yes.
The speech we heard on redistribution goes to 1998.
98, so 5 years later.
The Democratic National Convention opener comes to 2012.
So 14 years later.
Yeah, so really we're looking at now what will be essentially 20 years. And, of course, we know it's much, much, much older than that, because this is the same kind of chatter that Jimmy Carter engaged in. It died out in the 80s because it almost killed the economy. It all but drove a stake through the heart of the economy. And as you mentioned earlier, Jimmy Carter's grandson should have shut up and sat down, because the only thing that was making his grandfather look good was Barack Obama, because no longer Jimmy Carter the worst president in American history. Barack Obama was very rapidly moving into that much not sought after position. And instead he decides he's going to try to, well, maybe what he's doing, maybe there's method to his madness. Maybe he wants Obama to have 2 terms. So he cements his place as the worst president in American history. So that kind of thinking, that kind of logic knows no bounds, I guess. But we have to realize that these guys are operating on a meme. Conservatives are falling all over themselves to say, me too. Well, we're going to do this too, but we're going to do it a different way. So I guess maybe they're trying the fourth way. Is that what maybe that's what the Republicans are looking at? Really, ladies and gentlemen, we're fighting over which form of the third way we're going to implement. Because of course no one right now would give any credence to anybody who admitted to being a Marxist. But yet all you have to do is know something of having read Marx, know something about Marxist philosophy to realize that Barack Obama and a number of Republicans are talking about huge portions of the 10 planks of communism. You know, free public education, graduated income tax, things like attempting to move people out of the countryside and into the cities. You know, all you have to do is look at Agenda 21. Well, a number of our Republican state house members have moved up from city councils where they were highly active in stripping you of your property rights.
Yes. Well, or stripping you of your ability to repeal taxes.
Well, let's talk about that. Thank you for bringing that up.
You're welcome.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. I live in the city of Westerville, and of course, Westerville is now on record as having shown that while you can use the vote, you can use a majority vote to pass a tax, you are not allowed to vote to repeal it, according to the Ohio Supreme Court. And they are interpreting a law written by the Ohio State Legislature, run by Republicans, ladies and gentlemen, and we have a non-mixed government. We have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican governor, and yet they have done nothing to make sure that if you don't like the taxes you're paying on your property, you can repeal them. Sorry, folks. Once you pass them, you are stuck with them.
At least that is the ruling that came out unanimously, might I add, from the Ohio Supreme Court on Thursday, or maybe it was on Wednesday. I can't remember which day it actually came out. But basically, in a unanimous ruling of the seven judges, six of whom are Republicans, one who's a Democrat, they decided, Chuck, that the voters had no right to go back and repeal a tax that had been put in place. They can only repeal one that has been voted on but not enacted.
And the reasoning that they used was a serious legal tap dance. And it had to do with past millages versus the actual amount of tax that you pay. This is way too complex to get into with the minute and a half that we have left in the show.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just put it this way. You do not pay the full millage that is passed on your home, most likely. You pay a reduced millage based on the amount of money that the levy was designed to raise. And what happens as your property value goes up is that your effective millage goes down in order for that revenue to stay the same. Well, who in Central Ohio's property values have risen in the last 5 years? Not mine.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think in these last 5 years very many could say that.
So the fact is our effective millage rates are actually going up. And Westerville has been coming back to the well and coming back to the well and coming back to the well. Our teachers are already way, frankly, I realize that I'm going to make people mad. They're way overpaid. They got 9 months work, 7 hours a day, 8 hours a day, which is, you know, standard working day. 9 months work, though, you know, I don't get to work 9 months. I got to work all 12. I'm lucky if I get 2 weeks off. My 2 weeks are then used at work. And they're making, on average, in the high 60s. In many cases, actually, I think they're making $72,000 on average. Barry, that's just about what I make for my 12 months a year and about 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's not working for me. I also have an education. I have a degree. And I just don't understand why teachers need to make more money than I do. Well, and administrators three times what I make.
Chuck, it's because we believe in redistribution. And and we have to have efficient government. And what could be more efficient than taking all of your money out of your property and putting it into a system that doesn't work.
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, Barry, we're out of time with that. I'm glad we got that in under the wire, and that might have been. But let's just say that the Ohio Supreme Court thinks that you don't have the right to decide whether you're going to be taxed or not. So thank you, Ohio Supreme Court. And with that, I'll say join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.